The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 28th, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows a young family. They've gathered on the couch. They've got pizza and popcorn in front of them. They've got a startled look on their face because they're looking at a black TV screen. It's broken. It has a fist coming through the screen at them, holding a red sign that says, "On Strike." The headline is, "No shows. Hollywood goes dark as actors join writers on the picket line." And I believe we pick that up as a business column later, but we will start with the main stories and how they were covered. Pentagon funding caught in culture war fight. What happened? Military funding was stalled by a culture war battle this week after House Republicans passed a defense authorization bill filled with amendments aimed at ending what they call woke military social policies. The National Defense Authorization Act, which sets military spending limits and dictates some Pentagon policy, has for decades passed with broad bipartisan support. But to appease members of the far-right Freedom Caucus who threatened to block the bill, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy allowed votes on their proposed amendments. That resulted in provisions that would end travel expenses for service members seeking abortions, eliminate the Pentagon's Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, the DEI, and deny troops medical coverage for gender transition treatments. "These are radical programs that are forced on troops at the expense of readiness," McCarthy said. The $886 billion bill passed the House 219-210, with four Republicans and all but four Democrats voting against it. "The defense bill has been transformed into an extremist manifesto," said House Minority Whip Catherine Clark, Democrat from Massachusetts. "The amended legislation stands no chance of passage in the Democrat-led Senate, which will now craft its own version, setting up a struggle to reconcile the two bills into a package that can clear both chambers." In the Senate, Alabama Republican Tommy Tuberville continued to block routine military promotions and nominations to protect Pentagon abortion policies. Since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, the military has provided travel reimbursement and paid time off to service members based in red states to seek out-of-state abortions. Tuberville has blocked more than 260 nominations, leaving the Marine Corps without a Senate-confirmed leader for the first time in over a century. President Biden assailed the senator for jeopardizing U.S. security, but Tuberville dug in. "I'm not changing my mind," he said. What the editorial said: the House's radical right contingent is apparently determined to expand the battle lines of their culture war into every aspect of governance, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "Since the military decides where troops are stationed, it's a matter of basic fairness to ensure that women serving their country can avail themselves of medical services that are still legal in half the states. The reckless zealotry of faux patriots in the GOP is not only threatens women in the military, but also the tradition of bipartisan support for national defense spending. Don't blame House conservatives for the division," said National Review. "Blame an administration determined to impose its woke policies even on our military. The Pentagon's abortion tourism policy is nakedly political And it's a farce to subject the already well-integrated military to the fad of DEI, a waste of time at best, and invidious influence at worst. Republicans want to put the military's focus where it belongs, the hard and indispensable work of fighting and winning the country's wars. What the columnist said, the far right used to rein in its political nihilism when it came to supporting our troops by voting them lots and lots of money, said Robert Schlesinger in the New Republic. It's a testament to how radical the Freedom Caucus has become that they have taken military funding hostage merely to score cheap political points with their constituents. Tuberville is right, said Rich Lowry in National Review. It's absurd for the Defense Department to claim that free and easy access to abortion is key to military readiness. It's not extreme for Republicans to want to return to the policies and procedures from the time before the woke revolution co-opted even the military. McCarthy must privately wonder, are you maniacs trying to lose the majority, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times, tying defense spending to anti-abortion extremism and bans on diversity training may play well in deep MAGA districts, but not so much in battleground areas, as the 2022 midterms demonstrated. But with a razor-thin House majority and a weak grasp on the Speaker's gavel, McCarthy has decided to appease the ideological terrorists who've taken him and the Pentagon hostage. Voters may punish Republicans for creating nonstop dysfunction and chaos, but in the meantime, the rest of America may wind up forced to pay a price as well. And we'll read a second shorter main story. January 6th indictment looms for Trump. What happened? Donald Trump faced growing legal peril this week after the Department of Justice told the Republican frontrunner that he is a target in its investigation into attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The former president posted on social media that he had received a target letter, which typically indicates an imminent criminal indictment, from special counsel Jack Smith inviting him to testify before a grand jury. The letter mentions potential charges of conspiracy to defraud the government, witness tampering, and deprivation of rights, NBCNews.com reports. Federal prosecutors have reportedly questioned witnesses about efforts to assemble slates of phony pro-Trump presidential electors in swing states won by Joe Biden. Investigators have also examined Trump's actions leading up to and during the January 6th insurrection. Trump called the investigation election interference by the Biden administration aimed at derailing his 2024 presidential campaign. In Florida, a pretrial hearing in the criminal case against Trump over the mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago ended this week without U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon setting a trial date. But Cannon, a Trump appointee, signaled she was skeptical of federal prosecutors' push to start the trial in December, and also of Trump's attorney's insistence that it take place after the 2024 election. In Georgia, the state Supreme Court unanimously rejected a request from Trump to quash an investigation by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis into whether Trump or his allies tried to tamper with the state's 2020 presidential election results. What the columnist said, Trump has already been indicted twice, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, but the January 6th charges, if they arrive, would center on the most profound of legal accusations, that he attacked the foundational principle that voters get to choose their leader. With his legal woes mounting, Trump's 2024 presidential bid is looking increasingly like an attempt to avoid jail time. If he returns to the White House, Trump could well instruct the Justice Department to drop this case, or even try pardoning himself. The likely January 6 charges are far more tenuous legally than those in the classified documents case, said Jonathan Turley in The Messenger. Smith needs to prove that the former president intended to break the law, not just that he was relying on bad advice while contesting the 2020 results. Given the highly combustible state of our politics, Smith had better have indisputable evidence of illegality if he brings charges. To casual observers, Trump is obviously guilty, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Everyone watched him claim he'd won an election he didn't. They listened to him pressure officials in 2020, including Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, to find votes for him. No president has ever attacked the basis of American democracy so directly. Even Nixon's misdeeds pale in comparison. Still, proving to juries beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump's actions constitute state and federal crimes will not be easy. No one can confidently predict a conviction. Controversy of the week. Bidenomics. Can the president persuade voters it's a success? Conservatives coined the sarcastic term Bidenomics last year to blame President Biden for runaway inflation. But in recent weeks, said James Surowiecki in The Atlantic, Biden has embraced that insult and is giving speeches selling the success of Bidenomics as a primary reason to reelect him. What changed? The economy did. New figures show U.S. inflation has fallen from a high of 8.3% to just 3%, compared with 8% in the U.K., with still no sign of the recession that many economists warned was coming as the Fed raised interest rates. On the contrary, job growth has continued for 30 straight months, producing a stunning 13 million jobs, the most ever in a single presidential term, and unemployment has sunk to a historic low of 3.6%, down from nearly 9% in 2020. Wages are finally rising faster than prices, and stocks are up 15% this year. In normal times, this deluge of good economic news would all but ensure Biden's reelection, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. But an absurdly low 34% of voters say they approve of Biden's economic stewardship. Why? It's a combination of relentless messaging about economic catastrophe by Republicans and conservative media, and the Biden administration's failure to promote its own success. The Biden team seems to have finally realized that if you want people to know how great the economy is, you have to start by saying the economy is great. Voters aren't stupid, said Veronique DeRugi in the Orange County Register. Most of the jobs Biden brags about creating were jobs lost in the pandemic. Their return is simply the product of reopening the economy. Yes, Biden may have goosed consumer spending and hiring with trillions of borrowed dollars for stimulus programs like Build Back Better and the Inflation Reduction Act, but that reckless spending directly fueled the inflation he now also wants credit for taming. Inflation came down for one simple reason. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. The best one can say about Bidenomics is that the economy has finally worked Biden's reckless spending out of the system. Ironically, red state workers have benefited more from Bidenomics than blue state ones, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. The job creation and uptick in wages have been heavily tilted to the poorest workers and blue-collar workers clustered in red states. For middle-class suburbanites, wages stayed largely stagnant while inflation raged. That stoked the continuing pessimism and frustration that could be politically treacherous for Biden. Wages are not the whole story, said Abba Batari in the Washington Post. New banking data shows that the amount of money in Americans' checking and savings accounts is a whopping 10 to 15% higher than it was pre-pandemic, largely due to government stimulus payments. The Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, which measures public optimism about the economy, just posted its largest month-on-month jump since 2005. There's always a time lag between the economy's performance and the public's ability to register it, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. Biden can't force American voters to realize how much better off they are than when he took office. But with the 2024 election little more than a year away, he needs to keep making the case for Bidenomics as persistently as he can. And our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for bird intelligence. After a team of biologists found that magpies in Antwerp, Belgium, are stealing spiked anti-bird strips from buildings and using them to build metal nests. They're outsmarting us, said biologist Ock Florian Hempstra. It was a good week for beer drinkers, with research showing that drinking even a single beer a day diversifies men's gut microbes and may reduce the risk of diabetes and heart disease. And it was a good week for Xi Jinping, who received a ringing endorsement for his authoritarian leadership from GOP presidential contender Donald Trump. President Xi runs 1.4 billion people with an iron fist, Trump said in an interview on Fox News. Smart, brilliant, everything perfect. But it was a bad week for Ernest Hemingway after Scotland's University of the Highlands slapped a trigger warning on his 1953 Pulitzer-winning novella, The Old Man and the Sea, alerting delicate readers to the presence of graphic fishing scenes. It was a bad week for misspeaking after Vice President Kamala Harris touted the environmental benefits of when we invest in clean energy and electric vehicles and reduce population. The White House later said that Harris meant to say reduce pollution. Finally, it was a bad week for digital messages after an unnamed French citizen sent one of their fingers through the mail to the home of President Emmanuel Macron. A presidential source says that while police have identified the finger's original owner, who is still living, it's not at all clear why this finger was sent to the president. Briefing this week, going to extremes. Adventure tourists are rocketing into space, plumbing the ocean's depths, and risking their lives in the pursuit of thrills. What is extreme tourism? Wealthy adventurers are paying huge sums to scale the world's highest peaks, trek to the poles, descend to the ocean's depths, and seek out some of the most remote and dangerous spots on Earth. This phenomenon was recently spotlighted when five men, including three adventure tourists who'd paid $250,000 apiece, died on a submersible, the Titan, which imploded as it descended to the wreckage of the Titanic, 2.4 miles deep in the Atlantic Ocean. One of the tourists, British billionaire Hamish Harding, had previously visited the South Pole and flown to the edge of space. Adventurers who pay for these trips are driven to constantly push the boundaries of their travels to chase thrills and claim bragging rights, said Peter Anderson of the global concierge firm Knightsbridge Circle. Unsatisfied by vacation journeys to Paris or the pyramids, they seek out more unique experiences, many of which involve a degree of risk, Anderson said. Why is this industry growing? One factor is the pandemic, which lit a fire under some people to seize the day. People are definitely going after the bucket list experiences, said Dan Richards, the CEO of Boston-based Global Rescue, which assists travelers in emergency situations. Extreme tourism is also a byproduct of a concentration of massive wealth among entrepreneurs and investors who are looking for other challenges to overcome. These are very focused, affluent, goal-driven people who want to be the most elite, said Eric Larson, who offers guided trips to the North and South Poles that start at $50,000. Extreme tourism is also driven by technology, which is increasing accessibility to the most remote frontiers, including space. Who's going to space? Three billionaire-led space travel companies, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin, and Elon Musk's SpaceX, are gearing up to send wealthy adventurers into orbit. And the financial services firm UBS predicts that the space travel market will be worth $3 billion by 2030. Last month, Virgin Galactic flew its first 90-minute commercial flight to the edge of space, 55 miles above Earth. It hopes to eventually send up 400 flights a year, with customers paying $450,000 to experience a few minutes of weightlessness and gaze down on Earth. Some 800 have reserved seats. Since 2021, Blue Origin has sent 31 passengers on an 11-minute, 62-mile rocket journey for an undisclosed fee. While in April, Musk's SpaceX ferried three civilians who paid an estimated $55 million apiece to spend 8 days on the International Space Station. A California-based company hopes to open a space hotel, the Voyager Station, by 2030 that will include villas, a gym, and a restaurant and bar, as well as artificial gravity created by its rotation. What other destinations are popular? Some venture to the ocean's depths. OceanGate, which operated the Titan, has suspended all operations. But a company called EYOS Expeditions charges $750,000 a person to bring adventurers in a titanium-hulled Triton submersible to the Mariana Trench, which at 36,000 feet is the deepest spot in the ocean. Other adventurers travel literally to the ends of the Earth, the North and South Poles. Antarctic travel in particular has seen a boom, with more than 105,000 visitors last year to a region that decades ago saw only a few hundred visitors a year. A five-day, 69-mile ski trip to the South Pole runs $75,000. Visitors can also take a private jet to White Desert, which for $15,000 a night offers luxury sleeping domes, gourmet dining, a yoga pod, and a sauna. Other extreme tourists are scaling mountain peaks, including Mount Everest, a fad not everyone is thrilled about. Why not? A record 463 climbing permits were issued at the world's tallest mountain during the spring climbing season, and a record 17 deaths followed. Veterans complain about inexperienced adventurers creating traffic jams, garbage and human waste on the trails, and requiring costly rescues. Other extreme journeys run a wide gamut: subsistence fishing on desert islands in the South Pacific, dog sledding in Alaska, heli-skiing in the Himalayas. Are there downsides to extreme tourism? Space trips put a lot of ozone-depleting pollutants into the atmosphere, while conservationists are sounding the alarm about degrading impacts of the throngs headed for Antarctica. The Titan debacle highlighted another issue: the need for costly, sometimes risky, rescue operations when things go awry. It's a fair question to ask whether or not governments should be in the business of saving people from themselves, said Richards of Global Rescue. One might think the Titan's grisly fate would dull the hunger for extreme experiences, but industry experts say the opposite is often true. Philip Brown of the London-based agency Brown & Hudson reported a marked increase in queries about extreme travel after the Titan. Instead of deterring people, tragedies sometimes generate interest, he said. More danger, it seems, produces more thrills worth paying for. And we'll pick up a few of the best columns. First two from the U.S. No Labels, Only Real Agenda. No Labels has no real agenda, except possibly to ensure Donald Trump's election in 2024, said Dennis Aftergut. The platform the avowedly centrist political group released this week for a possible third-party presidential candidate is 63 pages of middle-of-the-road political pablum. On divisive issues such as voting rights, No Labels is a font of banal platitudes such as, every legal vote should be counted. What does the qualifier legal mean in a nation in which Republicans insist voter fraud is rampant? No Labels proposes child tax incentives, but its honorary co-chair, Senator Joe Manchin, insisted on chopping those credits out of Build Back Better. The immigration section is a carbon copy of President Biden's approach, and on transgender rights, abortion, guns, and the national debt, the group's mealy-mouthed manifesto dodges specifics, letting voters read into it whatever they like. No Labels board members are mostly Republicans, and the group reportedly received $100,000 from Clarence Thomas' benefactor, billionaire Harlan Crow. The group's polling shows that if there were a three-way race, the authoritarian Trump will win, with far less than 50% of the vote. A vote for No Labels would severely endanger American democracy. COVID now an ordinary illness. The pandemic is finally over, said David Lenart. New data show that for the first time since March 2020, the total number of Americans dying each day from any cause is no longer historically abnormal. Excess deaths, as this statistic is known, are a useful way of gauging COVID's true toll because it accounts for undiagnosed COVID fatalities and indirect deaths. During the pandemic's worst phases, the number of Americans dying each day was a horrifying 30% above average. And for long stretches of the past 3 years, excess deaths remained above 10%. But over the last 3 months, excess deaths have fallen to near zero, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Credit that to the fact that about 97% of U.S. adults have developed some COVID immunity from vaccines, infections, or both. When vulnerable people do get COVID, antiviral treatments like Paxlovid can reduce severity and mortality, making nearly all COVID deaths preventable. About 80 people in the U.S. are still dying from COVID every day, mostly older, unvaccinated people. But after 3 horrific years and more than 1.1 million U.S. COVID deaths, the virus has turned into an ordinary illness. And we'll flip over and get that business column referenced in the cover drawing. Entertainment. Striking actors shut down Hollywood. Hollywood studios thought they could ride out the skirmish with the screenwriters and keep the entertainment factory going, said Meg James in the Los Angeles Times. Now, with Hollywood actors joining striking screenwriters last week for the biggest Tinseltown shutdown in more than 6 decades, things aren't turning out that way. Movie shoots have ground to a halt, with big-budget sequels like Gladiator 2 and Deadpool 3 shutting down in the middle of shooting. A-list stars have bailed on film and TV marketing campaigns, including the premiere of the upcoming Oppenheimer. And as of this week, there's no hint of progress in negotiations. The 160,000-member Actors Union, SAG-AFTRA, has argued that streaming has enabled studios to unfairly cut their pay. They also want protections against the use of AI to simulate background actors, potentially replacing extras on future sets. The simultaneous strikes couldn't come at a worse time for entertainment companies who are still trying to grapple with the economics of streaming, lower box office figures, and the demise of traditional broadcast and cable. The us against them, haves versus have-nots mood in Hollywood is straight out of Les Mis, said Brooks Barnes in the New York Times. Striking actors have pointed to the pay packages of studio heads. Warner Brothers Discovery's David Zaslav got an astonishing $246 million in 2021. But beneath the surface, the studios were already facing existential questions. The domestic box office is still down 21% from 2019. The cable television model, which studios like Disney and Paramount have relied on for decades for fat profit growth, is over. Then last year, Netflix reported a subscriber loss, and Wall Street's interest swiveled from the arms race for subscribers to a desire for profits. Unwieldy streaming services suddenly slashed billions of dollars in costs and eliminated more than 10,000 jobs. Now the unions are pushing back. There will be no fresh helpings of The White Lotus, The Last of Us, or even Emily in Paris, beaming into front rooms when summer fades, said Vanessa Thorpe in The Guardian. Americans, and much of the world with them, have gotten used to an endless stream of high-quality entertainment. But now they are coming face-to-face with the uncomfortable fact that even as entertainment choices have exploded, creators haven't shared in the bounty. In television, actors have traditionally had a base of income from reruns and other forms of reuse, said Michael Shulman in The New Yorker. But streaming has scrambled that model and endangered the ability of working actors to make a living. You might be tempted to dismiss striking actors as privileged elites whining about a dream job, said James Ponowitz in the New York Times. Don't, because beyond a few superstars, the great majority of actors are in much the same spot as the rest of us. In the grand scheme, most of us are background players facing down the same modern risk. That every time a technological or cultural shift happens, companies will rewrite the terms of employment to their advantage. We're on the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Blaming the Addicts. Around the country, addicts are being charged with murder for sharing fentanyl with friends, said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. Dealers and the cartels, meanwhile, rarely are prosecuted. Oklahoma City. Josh Askins woke up in the crawl space of an abandoned house with nausea, chills, and a shooting pain in his legs. It had been several hours since he last smoked fentanyl, and already he could feel his withdrawal symptoms worsening by the minute. He rolled over in his sleeping bag and stared at the graffiti he had carved into the rotting floorboards. "Fentanyl is hell," he had written a few weeks earlier. But now he got up and start looking for more. He walked across the street and saw his friend Chris Drake sitting on his grandmother's front porch in downtown Oklahoma City, watching the sunrise with a Budweiser in one hand and a Bible in the other. Drake, 47, was reading the book for the sixth time, and he and Askins, 42, had bonded during the past weeks over their shared faith, and also their shared failings. They had called a rehab facility that took Medicaid and made plans to detox there together with the help of medication. "I'm hurting really bad," Askins said that morning in late April. "Do you think you can get us a little something?" Drake asked him, according to court records. "I can always get us something," Askins said. They got into Drake's car about 5:30 a.m. and went to search for the drug that had rewired their bodies, their minds, and so much else about the United States, where in 2023, fentanyl and other synthetic opioids led to an average of 3,400 emergency room visits and 190 fatal overdoses each day. They drove to a Red Roof Inn and then to another extended stay motel near the airport, where, according to police reports, Askins met with a dealer who had sold him fentanyl before. Drake took out his wallet and handed cash to Askins, and Askins paid $30 for 0.3 gram of white fentanyl powder that looked like a pinch of sugar in a small plastic bag. They parked at a car wash, and Drake put the white powder into a piece of tinfoil, cooked it with a lighter, and inhaled the fumes. He took two hits, and Askins took one. Askins passed out for a few seconds. When he opened his eyes, he saw Drake slumped over and falling out of the passenger seat. "Put on your seat belt so you stay upright," Askins later remembered saying. But Drake didn't answer. "Hey, man, you all right?" Askins asked him. He shook his friend and tried to slap him back to consciousness, but his body was limp, and his lips were turning blue. Askins pulled up to a gas station and banged on the door. "Help," he shouted to the clerk. "My friend's overdosing. Call 911. He had learned CPR while working as a medical assistant in a nursing home, so he pulled Drake out of the car, laid him on the concrete, and performed chest compressions until a fire truck and two police officers arrived. The paramedics continued to work on Drake while Askins waited in a police car. An officer read him his Miranda rights and asked him about the events of that morning. It was Drake who first suggested they buy drugs. It was Drake who had enough money for fentanyl. It was Drake who wanted to get high and willingly took the first hit. But now the police officer told Askins that Drake had been pronounced dead, and the state of Oklahoma had reached its initial decision about who was to blame for the latest fatality in a national epidemic. Josh Askins, you are under arrest for murder in the first degree, the officer said. Justin Mai, 31, checked his mailbox in the Oklahoma County Public Defender's Office and saw a new case file, a manila folder with a red label that read, Murder 1. He had been working at the office for less than 2 years as a self-described baby lawyer, but already he had received 5 murder cases. Now he flipped through Askins' file and saw it was a fentanyl case that resembled a few of his others. He had worked on a murder case against a 24-year-old who delivered fentanyl to a friend's apartment and warned everyone to be careful before his friend licked the empty fentanyl bag and died of an overdose. He had defended a woman on a murder charge on murder charges after she left some of her fentanyl in a motel bathroom where her 43-year-old companion used the drugs and then died. Prosecutors in Alaska, California, Florida, and at least a dozen other states were beginning to pursue new murder cases against any defendant who fit the wide-ranging definition of a fentanyl dealer. A 17-year-old in Tennessee who, after graduation, shared fentanyl in the high school parking lot with 2 of her friends, both of whom died. A husband in Indiana who bought fentanyl for his disabled wife, who overdosed while trying to numb her chronic pain from multiple sclerosis, a real estate agent in Florida who threw a party and called 911 when one of her guests overdosed. The Oklahoma City police officers in Askins' case hadn't tracked the fatal dose of fentanyl back to a cartel manufacturer, or to a drug trafficker, or to a big-time dealer, or even to the street-level dealer known as Sug, who had sold the fentanyl to Askins and Drake, and whose name Askins had given to the police at the scene. Instead, they arrested and charged only one person, Askins, who had a criminal record of nonviolent drug offenses. His file showed he had depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder from being raped by a neighbor when he was 9. His current address was listed as transient, and he had told officers that he supported his own addiction by reselling food he found in dumpsters and donating plasma twice each week. The reality of Mai's job meant managing 80 or 90 cases at once. In his almost 2 years as a public defender, Mai had never once taken a case to trial. "This is one we're going to fight," he told Askins when they met one morning at the county jail. Askins had a bond hearing coming up, and Mai planned to ask the judge to reduce his bond to $50,000 from $250,000 so that Askins could possibly get out of jail while his case continued through the courts. "Murder," Askins said, still trying to make sense of it. "If I'm found guilty, I could be looking at what? Life in prison? Life without parole?" Askins asked. "Technically, yes," Mai said. "But who's going to support that?" A few days later, 2 prison guards led Askins into a courtroom for his bond hearing on the charge that he murdered Drake. Askins had red welts on his neck from the bedbugs that infested the county jail, and he scratched at his skin with handcuffs as he scanned the galley for his family. He spotted his mother, Sean Armstrong, who had recently tried to hang herself in the backyard because of her heartbreak over the latest saga in her son's 25 years of addiction, and his stepfather, who helped cut down the rope, and his 92-year-old grandmother, who had slept in the same bed as his mother for the past 3 weeks. "I'm so sorry for putting you all through this," Askins told them. He wiped his eyes and turned back toward the front of the room as Mai stood to address the judge. "This is a very unusual first-degree murder charge," Mai said. "We have an unfortunate and sad accidental drug overdose, but we shouldn't put that accident on my client. Even accusing him of murder causes real harm. Stigmatizing drug addicts, punishing people who call 911. It's clear that my client is not a drug dealer. He was a middleman. A middleman is a drug dealer, the prosecutor said. They buy drugs from someone and distribute them. This person's drug problem has directly led to a death in our county. The question of who should be held accountable for fentanyl overdoses has led to debate within the offices of prosecutor's boss, Vicky Bahena, Oklahoma County's newly elected district attorney. Bahena promised to continue Oklahoma County's recent tradition of charging traffickers and distributors with murder to hold them accountable to the full extent of the law. But she was also a Democrat and the former head of the Oklahoma Innocence Project. In June, she decided her office would change its policy and begin charging some drug users involved in fentanyl deaths with first-degree manslaughter instead of first-degree murder. But for now, the judge looked at Askin's file and saw only the original charge at the top of the page. Murder in the first degree is very serious, she told him as she prepared to give her ruling. At this point in time, I have to assume that the apparent likelihood of conviction is great. You have to be held accountable. I'm keeping the bond at $250,000. Askins nodded. Thank you, Your Honor, he said. Can I please hug my family? I'm sorry. I believe we have a rule against that, the judge said. She gestured for the guards to take Askins back upstairs to his cell. Askins called his mother from his prison cell a few hours later. She answered as she drove out of the city toward her small ranch. I can't do this anymore, he told her. His next preliminary hearing wasn't until August. I can't be in here. You're strong. You're loved, she said. Remember how much you're worth. No, listen, he said. I'm telling you, I'm done. She stared ahead out the window and at the windswept prairie as a familiar anxiety came rushing back into her chest and throat. She'd spent the past 2 decades losing her son to addiction, imagining him in abandoned houses, writhing in withdrawal or smoking the fentanyl dose that would kill him. Her one solace with Askins in prison was the belief that he was in some ways protected from his disease. He was trapped. He was safe. You just have to confront reality, she said. There's no escaping. There's no other choice. Well, actually, he said, and then he started to tell her a story from several weeks earlier when he first arrived at the Oklahoma County Jail with the same shooting pains and nausea that drove him to buy fentanyl that morning with Drake. He had prepared himself for full-fledged withdrawal in jail, but then he saw his roommate smoking synthetic marijuana and heard about other prisoners making alcohol out of hand sanitizer. It turned out that the jail had treated more than 130 inmates for drug overdoses in the past year, and more than a dozen had died since 2021. Within a few days, Askins figured out that fentanyl was all over the facility, sold by every jailhouse gang in every variety and available for purchase by trade or by favor. He started snorting small doses at night so he could drown out his surroundings for long enough to sleep. The nightmares kept coming. His doses got bigger. He took a little more to keep himself from thinking about Drake. He took more each time he heard his mother crying on the phone. More for the bedbugs. More for the loneliness and the shame and the anger and the fear. Until one night he sat in his roommate's bed and snorted 2 lines of white powder, numbing himself into oblivion with 4 times his typical dose. His vision went dark. When he woke a while later, he was strapped into a restraining jacket and staring up at a team of nurses and medical assistants in the jail. They said it had taken 4 doses of naloxone, the opioid reversal drug, to revive him. He immediately went into withdrawal and said he hadn't used fentanyl since. I almost died, he told his mother. They had to bring me back. Thank God, she said. Yeah, he said. I guess. She looked out the window at the red dirt roads of Oklahoma where fentanyl was everywhere, and she listened to her son breathe until her exhaustion and her anger formed into the same desire for accountability that had swept across the country and put her son in jail. How? Who did this to you? She asked, and this time Askin was sure of the answer. It was me, he said. Blame me. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. And we have time for one of the articles on the Talking Points page. Diet soda, an increased risk of cancer? Diet sodas, sugar-free chewing gum, cereals, even toothpaste and chewable vitamins. The artificial sweetener aspartame is used in more than 6,000 products, which helps explain why there was an uproar last week after the World Health Organization's cancer research arm classified aspartame as possibly carcinogenic, said Miriam Nadaf in Nature. Approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 1974, aspartame, also known by the brand name Equal, was associated with statistically significant increases in breast, liver, and other forms of cancer. WHO said after analyzing numerous studies, the increased risk is so small, however, that it probably isn't worth worrying about, said epidemiologist Gideon Meyerowitz-Katz in STAT. One of the studies cited by WHO found that drinking aspartame regularly for a decade increased cancer rates by 0.2%. A meaningless risk for the average individual. Despite WHO's announcement, Big Food just can't quit aspartame, said Julie Creswell in the New York Times. It's one of the least expensive sugar alternatives, and people like the way it tastes. About 8 years ago, PepsiCo responded to concerns about possible health risks by removing aspartame from its diet soda. But the replacement sweeteners, sucralose and acesulfame potassium, had a different taste, and sales flopped. Soon, aspartame was back in Diet Pepsi. So manufacturers are unlikely to change ingredients this time, despite a recent spate of research suggesting that artificial sweeteners don't help weight control and are even linked to an increased risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular diseases. For years, people like me have assumed that switching to zero-calorie sodas would give us license to guzzle them guilt-free, said Susan Puckett in CNN.com. But studies have shown artificial sweeteners can trick the body into craving calories. In fact, said F.D. Flam in Bloomberg, a University of Texas study found that people who drink two or more diet sodas a day experience waistline increases 500% greater than did people who don't drink the stuff. That may be because artificial sweeteners interfere with our community of microbes that live in our guts, the microbiome, which plays a major role in our health. So rather than switch back to sodas heavily sweetened with regular sugar or corn syrup, it might be best to put down the can and pour yourself a glass of water. And a couple of the shorter notes. About 70% of prisoner cells in Texas have no air conditioning, and heat indexes inside the prisons are soaring above 110 degrees. At least 9 prisoners died in recent weeks of what prison officials say are unknown causes. Up to 44 U.S. states have at least some prisons that are not fully air-conditioned. A super PAC aligned with Donald Trump's paid Trump's wife, Melania, a $155,000 fee in connection with an event in late 2021. A representative for the now-defunct Make America Great Again said Melania was paid for design consulting and that her responsibilities included arranging settings and choosing tableware and floral arrangements. Home insurance prices have skyrocketed in hurricane-battered Florida, hitting an average of $4,200, 3 times the national average. At least 6 insurers went insolvent in the state last year, and this month, Farmers stopped issuing new home, car, and umbrella policies in the state, citing growing risk exposure. And we time for 2 quotes. Thomas Edison says, "Opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work." And Kierkegaard says, "Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.